Thanks very much for those kind words. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I love talking about Homer, and it's a chance for me to put across a book that I spent quite a few years on. Took me about as long as the Trojan War, about 10 years. So it's very nice to be able to share it with a wider public, and I hope you'll enjoy the lectures. I've got notes here, and I'll look at them from time to time. I prefer to talk directly to the audience. May mean I get slightly lost from time to time. You just have to forgive me. I will, at the beginning of each lecture, just put up a slide showing the kind of main headings that I'll be talking about for that lecture. So you'll get some idea of what that particular lecture is going to be about, and you can start grumbling if it looks as if we're not getting through fast enough. Okay, I should say what I kind of know about and don't know about. I mean, my expertise is really in ancient literature, to some extent modern literature, particularly poetry. That's what interests me. I'm not an expert on ancient history and archaeology. I'm going to do a quick whip through those sort of areas in the first part of this lecture, but I'm a kind of interested amateur in those areas. Some of you may will know as much, probably more than I do, about the archaeology of Troy and so on. But I will touch on those areas, as well as my main focus, which is the Iliad itself, what it's about, and translation, the way it's been put into English. Okay, so today, basically, an introduction to the Iliad. As I said, I will touch on the historical town of Troy, and this hugely vexed question whether the Trojan War that Homer tells about in Iliad has got any basis in historical fact. It's really a question that's almost impossible to settle one way or the other, you know, unless some kind of diary from a Trojan pitches up in some excavation at some time, talking about what happened exactly at the time. We really can never be sure, but there are very tantalizing parallels between the historical and archaeological record and what Homer has to say. So we'll look at some of that. Equally, perhaps even more vexed question, who was Homer? When did he live? Was he one person, two people, a committee? Again, questions that are extremely difficult to answer and have questions that have been answered in very different ways at different times and in different places. And then I want to end with, how was the Iliad composed? That is, I think, something that we know a little bit more about now than we did, say, 200, 150, 200 years ago. So there have been very interesting developments in the study of the composition of a poem of this kind, a long epic poem like the Iliad. Okay, our subject is the Iliad of Homer, an ancient Greek epic poem, about 15,000 lines long. It is a poem, though some of you will have met it in prose translations. And so, a substantial work. I'll say it dates from around the middle to the end of the 8th century BC. But that's, you know, that's the best guess at present. It's by no means established final fact, but probably somewhere between around 750, 700 BC, the Iliad took on something like its present form. Of course, the poem tells about the fighting around the town of Troy, and that's an action that involves not only humans, not only heroes, but of course also gods. So the poem operates on more than one level. And it's called Iliad rather than Troyad because Homer's got two names for this town. He calls it Troyer in Greek, or Troia in a kind of Latin version. And he also calls it Ilios or Ilion. So that's why it's called Iliad rather than Troyad. But Homer uses both names. And we'll see a bit later in the lecture that there's some fascinating, fairly recent, say in the last half century or so, evidence that these names may have existed in contemporary documents from not that far from the area of Troy. Okay, as I've said, I want to leave aside who was Homer for the moment and just say something fairly quickly about the archaeological record, the historical town of Troy. Okay, here's a map just to orientate you, mainland Greece, Crete. There's Troy up in the northwest corner of Anatolia, Asia Minor, call it what you want. And it's clear that Homer, in composing the Iliad, thought of Troy as being up there where it is marked Troy, because he talks about he talks about these islands round about, the island of Tenedos there, island of Imbros, the island of Samothrace, Lesbos, Mount Ida. Mustn't confuse that, there's another Mount Ida on Crete, it's the one, the Trojan one. So that's clearly the geography that he assumes for the action of the Iliad. And of course he talks quite often about this narrow strait which leads to from the Aegean Sea to the Black Sea. The Hellespont also features in the Iliad. So it's clearly assuming that general region. And later Greeks and Romans rebuilt a town that they called Troy, New Ilium, on that site. So they assumed that was where the Iliad happened. Okay, not only did they build there, but in general in the ancient world, it was assumed that the Iliad was a historical document. The Greeks assumed that it was the earliest document of their history. So they believed that people like Agamemnon, Achilles — I'll use the names that I use in my translation, Achilles, Achilles, that same person — Agamemnon, Achilles, Odysseus, Diomedes, Priam, the chief of Troy, the ruler of Troy, they assumed that these were historical people. And that wasn't only naive Greeks and Romans, but even the first scientific historian in the West, Thucydides, writing in the later 5th century, he assumes that what Homer relates is essentially historical. He certainly believes in the reality of the Trojan War as fact. Okay, the problem was that gradually those memories faded through later antiquity and the Middle Ages. And by the time you get to the 1800s, the 19th century of our era, what, nearly 200 years ago now, when you get to the 19th century, the scholarly consensus was that the story that Homer tells is essentially a myth. It's in a rationalistic, positivistic criticism, said that this was all invented, it was a beautiful story, like Camelot or the Knights of the Round Table. It was believed simply to be Homer's own invention. Okay, that was until Heinrich Schliemann came along and began to excavate at a town called Hissarlik. Let's have a look first at Schliemann. There he is, German Heinrich Schliemann. I can see his dates there, 1822 to 1890. Schliemann was a tremendous self-publicist. He wrote a number of autobiographies. He was always promoting himself and his digs and his life story. And he claimed that right from a child he believed in the truth of Homer, the truth of the reality of the Trojan War, and that someday he would find Troy, he would dig it up, he would prove the scholars wrong, that Troy really did exist, that there really was a Trojan War. He didn't have much education. He was amazingly self-educated. He became a merchant, taught himself about 12, 14 languages. He corresponded in all of them, a remarkable linguist. And he made himself a fortune, apparently not always by very scrupulous means, but anyway, he earned a vast amount of money, which enabled him in his 40s to dedicate himself to archaeology. You must remember, archaeology at this time hardly existed as a science. So, you know, Schliemann did some terrible things, what we regard as terrible now, but he was a pioneer and an amateur. So, you know, one has to give him credit for what he got right and can't really be too hard on him for what he got very wrong. Okay, he gradually became convinced that Homer's Troy was at a place called Hisarlik, a small hill at the end of a plateau up near the Dardanelles. There were a number of competing sites round about that other people had thought might be Troy, but this is where Schliemann dug. And he dug there for about 10 years, about 20 years, between 1870 and 1890, in a series of campaigns. He kept coming back. As I say, you know, archaeology as a science hardly existed then. Schliemann's interest really was to just get as far down under the ground as he could, because he was convinced that Homer's Troy must be very old and down near the bottom, below all the later rebuildings. So he half destroyed the site. I mean, this is part, he dug a massive, removed the whole top of the hill. This is part of a huge trench that he drove right through the middle of the hill. And eventually he went down through the levels. He soon realized that this was a place which had been settled over and over again for nearly 3,000 years. So the layers went far back, town after town had been built on the same spot. Eventually, down at a low level, he came on a fairly large defensive wall and a gate, and he decided that must be the Troy of Homer, the Troy of the Trojan War. That was the level that archaeologists now call Troy 2. So obviously you start from the bottom up, Troy 1 is at the bottom, and then as the towns get younger, their numbers go up. He pronounced that to be the Troy of Homer. And on the final day of excavation, this was something Schliemann was rather good at. He kind of rather coincidentally, and some people think not so coincidentally, made these spectacular discoveries just at the end of the period of excavation. On the very last day that he was excavating here, he came on a hoard of treasure in a large vessel, gold and silver vessels all packed together, which he pronounced to be the treasure of Priam. So the treasure of the ruler of Troy, Priam. And I'll come back to this. This is actually not a part that Schliemann himself dug up, but this has got a better claim to being, if there is a historical Troy behind the Iliad, this Troy, which is much later, Troy 6. Anyway, Schliemann had married a woman more than 20 years younger than him, a Greek, Sophia, and he dressed her up, this famous photograph, I'm sure some of you have seen, in some of the jewels, which are called the jewels of Helen or the treasure of Priam, and this photo flashed all around the world, kind of with Schliemann now able to claim that he had actually discovered the Troy of the Iliad and of the myth or the story of the Trojan War. The difficulty was there were problems. Troy 2 dates back to the 3rd millennium. It's around 2600 down to 2250 BC. And that's more than 1,000 years earlier than the date which had always traditionally been associated with the Trojan War. The Greeks and the Romans traditionally dated the Trojan War to round about 1200, just after 1200 BC. Troy too, as I say, belonged to a period more than 1,000 years earlier. So there was this huge gap that Schliemann just didn't worry about, but kind of better scholars than him, archaeologists and ancient historians, said there's a problem here. This, the site needs to be investigated further, and that's what happened over the next 100 and more years. If we go back to this piece of wall, Schliemann, you know, to his credit, he knew that he was an amateur, and he often asked for professional advice. And he associated with his excavations in the later stages a younger archaeologist, a professional archaeologist, Wilhelm Derbfeld. I don't know if any of you have been to Olympia, the site of the ancient Olympic Games. That was Derbfeld's great excavation. But Derbfeld excavated with Schliemann in the later stages. He realized the problem, and he excavated in a different part of the hill. Schliemann's Troy was over there, and Derbfeld excavated over here. That bit of wall that you see is here. That's that narrow passage there between that bit and that bit over there. And this was what Derbfeld excavated was Troy 6, dated to around the middle of the 13th century down to 13th century BC down to the early 12th century. So exactly at the period that ancient tradition said the Trojan War had occurred. So for Derbfeld, this was the Troy of the Iliad. Okay, if we can move away from Schliemann and Troy for a moment. Very interesting parallel research, you know, while the archaeologists have been digging up sites on the mainland like Mycenae, which I won't be talking about, and Troy and Pylos and elsewhere. A whole new civilization was discovered in the interior of Anatolia from about the middle of the 19th century onwards. Here's the Anatolian Peninsula, there's Troy, and remains were found which clearly belonged to the same civilization. And one that scholars had hardly guessed existed, which seemed to stretch right across this area. They found at this area, this place here, they found a huge archive of baked clay tablets with cuneiform writing on them. But they weren't in any of the languages, the known languages of the Near East. They were in Babylonian or Akkadian, they were in some unknown language. And gradually it began to dawn on scholars and ancient historians that this place, this kingdom, was one which occurs in the Bible, known as Hatti, and we know now as the Hittite kingdom. And once the language was deciphered in 1915, it was found that it actually was an Indo-European language. So, much to everyone's amazement, it was not a Semitic language, it was a language related to Greek, Latin, Germanic languages, English, that large family of languages that we know as Indo-European. And the fascinating thing about what's so people could now read these clay tablets, a lot of diplomatic correspondence, clearly there were links between the capital of the Hittite kingdom at Hattusha, all the way to Assyria, Babylonia, Egypt. And very interestingly, they talk about the kingdom Ahiyawa. Okay. Now, Homer's name for mainland Greece is Achaia. I put it up on the map earlier, you would have seen it. Greece is a much later name, and the Greeks don't call themselves Greeks, they call themselves
Hellenes. And Homer's name for mainlanders is Achaia, and Achiawa seems tantalizingly close. Many scholars accept that these references in Hittite literature to Achiawa are references to Achaia. Even more, or as interestingly, they mention a place called Melusa, which it's very tempting to connect with Ilios, which actually had a W sound on it in early Greek, the Digamos, which was a letter that dropped out of Greek later. But Homer would call it Willios, Willion. And so Melusa very much suggests Willios as well. And even more tantalizing, there's a place in Melusa. Melusa seems to be the region for the Hittites rather than a town. But within that, there's a place called Truisa, which again makes one think of Troia, which would be the one of the Homeric names. And there's even correspondence with a leader of this place, a leader of Melusa called Alexandru. And there's this strange phenomenon in the Iliad that Homer calls Paris, the son of the ruler of Troy, of Priam. Homer calls Paris by an alternative name, Alexandros. It's never really been explained why he's got these two names. But, you know, perhaps this is a genuine historical memory of an actual ruler of a historical Troy. Again, you know, there's just so many coincidences here that one thinks these references must be to a historical Troy, and Achiawa I've already talked about. Okay, further excavation at Troy carried on. There were American excavations in the 1930s, and then there's been a very large-scale ongoing campaign since 1988, led by a German archaeologist, Manfred Korfmann, from the University of Göttingen, and he died about 7 years ago, but the excavations are ongoing. And Korfmann was interested in the problem that the historical Troy within the walls, the walls of Troy 6, which he, like Derbfeldt, thought was the Troy of the Trojan War. The problem was it was terribly small. How could this be regarded as a mighty city when it's only 200 meters by 100 meters or so across? Tiny little citadel. And he thought this must indeed just be a citadel and the main town must lie round about. So that's what he concentrated on. And it turned up a number of remains that he was convinced belonged to a lower town. And that Troy was actually very extensive at this time, Troy 6, around about 1250 BC, down to around 1200, and that it may have contained as many as 5,000 people. This was a reconstruction that he came up with, which has been very controversial. One of his own colleagues at the University of Göttingen says it's pure fantasy. It's just, you know, he's found a few little bits here and there and he's extrapolated this massive town. So it's controversial, but Korfmann was convinced that Troy was much larger. So there's the bit that we've just seen, that's that. And this is his idea of the lower town with a wall running right round it and several gates and remains of post holes in the ground that he thinks belong to a wooden palisade. Okay, so that's really all I want to say about Troy. It seems likely that there's some historical fact behind the Iliad, but exactly what it's, you know, we can say there was almost certainly a large, important town at Troy. There was certainly fighting there, but whether what's described in the Iliad is anything like what actually happened is another matter. I lost a battery. Where's my... Hang on, let me just get this back together. Okay. So, yeah, that's... I think we can advance it on here. Here's a kind of general reconstruction of what the plain of Troy might have looked like at the time of Troy 6. Notice the bay silted up. Thank you. That happened in a lot of places in along that coast. You know, places like Ephesus and Miletus that were great ports in the ancient world are now a couple of kilometers away from the sea. And the same thing happened at Troy. All the silt brought down by the river Scamander, the river Simois, have silted up the bays of the present coastlines far away. There's Troy, this is where people imagine the Greek troops might have been, but some other scholars think they might have been here. So, you know, whether this corresponds to what's in the Iliad is really very difficult to say. Really mentioned. There's even a wooden horse at Troy. I don't know if any of you have been to Troy. Yeah. I'll show you two versions of the wooden horse. It illustrates quite nicely the sort of difference between different ideas about Homer that I'll come back to when I talk about translation. This is a sort of rather classical looking horse. Here the tourist obediently climbing up the ladder, looking out at the portals. So this is fairly classical looking. This is a more sort of modern, rougher, anthropological type wooden horse. And this is actually the one that was used in the movie Troy with Brad Pitt. It's been set up in the nearby town of Çanakkale, which is the closest town to the site of Troy in Turkey, and there for the tourists to take photos of. Okay, I'd like to leave the last word on this subject to a scholar and a novelist. Here's what one of the great Homer scholars, Joachim Lataksch of the University of Basel, in his book Homer, der erste Dichter des Abendlandes, Homer, the first poet of the West, he says, for the appreciation of the Iliad as a work of art, the historicity or the fictionality of its alleged originating events is irrelevant. The Iliad would remain a literary masterpiece, even if the Trojan War had never happened. And that's, you know, it's nice to think that it did happen, but really, for the appreciation of the Iliad, doesn't matter too much. The novelist is Howard Jacobson. I was just reading some of his journalism recently and came across this, and I thought it fitted quite well with the same idea. The impulse to unravel a work of art in an attempt to discover the circumstances that occasioned it, to find the truth behind the fiction, is necessarily inimical to art. So he's even stronger. He thinks the whole idea of trying to find history behind a poem or fiction, I suppose fiction begs the question, because perhaps the Iliad is not fiction, but he certainly wouldn't approve of trying to find historical reality. Okay, I come now to the second part of my lecture, to Homer and the Iliad itself, and the so-called Homeric question. The so-called Homeric question is basically about who Homer was, his date, how his poems were composed. And it's long been known by that portmanteau phrase, the Homeric question. The fact is, of course, that we've got this long poem. It's come down to us in manuscripts, copied and recopied over thousands of years, and obviously since the later 15th century in printed books as well. But almost everything about it is disputed. That's an ancient, sort of about 700 or 800 years after Homer, for what they thought he looked like then. And of course, it's not in any sense a portrait sculpture. Here's again our map of Achaia, Homer's Greece. Okay, first of all, Homer himself. It's quite clear that the ancients knew virtually nothing about Homer. I mean, from the wildly different and conflicting stories they tell, it's obvious they're just sucking it out their thumb, basically. A favorite technique for a lot of ancient biography was just to look at an author's works, a poem like Virgil or Homer, or whoever it was, see what they wrote about and kind of extrapolate from that that their own work is autobiographical, which is a pretty dodgy basis for biography. Homer was said to have been born in several cities of Ionia. Ionia is this region around here. Miletus is one of them. Island of Chios, he had a very close association. Island of Chios there, but Smyrna as well. But then some people said he was born at Athens, or he was born in Egypt. It's even a version that he was born in Rome. So most of this clearly is fantasy. This area has probably the best claim because of the kind of Greek that he uses. It's basically the Greek of Ionia, Ionic Greek. Homer, of course, is famously believed to have been blind, but again, that's probably just an extrapolation from his poems. In the Odyssey, there's a famous bard who comes on and sings a song, and he's blind. So no doubt the ancients thought, oh, well, this is a self-portrait of Homer. He's giving us a portrait of himself in this blind bard of the Odyssey. There's also another piece of evidence, if one can dignify it with that name. In the ancient world, Homer was thought to have been the author not just of the Iliad and the Odyssey, but a whole lot of early poetry that wasn't attached to any particular name. And Homer was particularly thought to be the author of the so-called Homeric hymns, a group of hymns to the gods. And in one of those, the hymn to the god Apollo, the hymn talks about the poet that people most enjoy. Who's the poet that people most enjoy? The blind man who lives in rocky Chios. That's the little island that I showed you. There, rocky Chios. The blind man who lives in rocky Chios, whose songs will always reign supreme. So again, people thought this was Homer giving himself a bit of a plug for his own poetry. Okay, two epics, as I've said, were always attributed to him in antiquity, the Iliad and the Odyssey. But even there were some doubters. There were so-called separators, scholars who thought Homer might have composed or did compose the Iliad, but the Odyssey was by some different later poet. So, as you can see, virtually everything about the poet is very obscure and uncertain. Okay, right through, we're not going to talk about the whole history of Homer and thoughts about him, but right through the later antiquity, certainly among the Romans, later antiquity, the Middle Ages, Homer remained a great, if at times shadowy, poetic name. He was always associated with the Trojan War. You must remember that knowledge of Greek was pretty much lost in Western Europe right through the Middle Ages. Survived, of course, in the East, Constantinople and the eastern part of the Roman Empire. But Greek was almost entirely unknown. So Homer could not have been read in Greek anywhere in Western Europe for at least 1,000 years, or maybe one or two places, but virtually nowhere in Western Europe for 1,000 years or more. Dante, for example, in the second half of the 13th century, early 14th century, he knows Homer is a great name. He calls Homer poeta sovrano, sovereign poet. But he didn't know Greek, and he only knew Homer was great because he read it in Latin literature, particularly in Virgil, of course, whom he knew intimately. An important point also to bear in mind when we're thinking about how Homer and his poems have been understood is that really any kind of historical consciousness is quite a recent development. It's really only in the later 17th century of people like Gian Battista Vico, and then particularly in the 18th century, that you get the rise of a kind of historical consciousness. I mean, if you look at something like this. Here's a French manuscript from the 15th century, the building and rebuilding of Troy. There you can see Troy in flames. You can see the flames there. Troy being rebuilt here. Here's the ruler of Troy. This is an earlier Troy before the Trojan War. This is Laomedon, an earlier ruler of Troy before Priam. His town was also destroyed. He's appealing to the gods here. But everything is absolutely contemporary. I mean, the statues are kind of Gothic. He's dressed like a contemporary king. the stonemasons and workers here dressed like contemporary peasants. They're the Greeks in their ships. You know, absolutely, the architecture is that of 15th century France. And that was the norm, as I say, really up until the later 17th and the 18th century, when the idea begins to develop that the past, and particularly the distant past, may have been radically different from our own times. And that was a very slow notion to develop. If we apply that to Homer, in the 18th century particularly, you get the idea gradually growing that Homer might not have been a poet like a contemporary poet. He might not have been someone who sat quietly in his study with a huge supply of paper, slowly writing out his poems with a quill pen. But that he actually might have been a different kind of poet. And you know, this was quite a new idea, that a poet of of the distant past might have been very different from contemporary poets. And people of a more historical turn of mind began to put together two notions. Firstly, the fact that the ancients, the Greeks and the Romans, tended to date Homer quite early to pretty much the time of the Trojan War itself, around the 10th, 9th century BC. So they put Homer much earlier than later writers have done. And they argued correctly that alphabetic writing was not known in Greece at that time. So then they came up with a second idea, that Homer must have been an unlettered poet who didn't have access to writing. So he must have been an oral poet, must have composed his poems orally. So that idea already started, was you know, around and out there in the 18th century, and quite a few scholars embraced that notion. The problem was that they didn't know very much about oral poetry. You know, it was easy for them to say, well, Homer must have been an unlettered, I don't like to say illiterate, because it's like, you know, it's a sort of negative thing. You know, poets can be great oral poets without knowing writing, so let's say without writing. The problem was that scholars at that time really knew very little about oral poetry and exactly how it operated. Now that all changed in the 20th century. The early 20th century, a whole new direction was given to Homeric studies of Homeric epic by a young American scholar, Milman Parry, and this man looks older than him, but in fact was younger. It's just the picture was taken much later in his life. So Milman Parry, who started his researches in the 1920s, and his younger collaborator, Albert B. Lord. Over there you can see his dates by 1991. I actually had the privilege of meeting him. He came to a conference that we put on in Durban about oral poetry in 1985, and it was wonderful to meet someone who had such a huge influence on Homeric scholarship and had a direct line back to Milman Parry. Okay, Parry, if I can just describe what Parry did. Parry's initial intuition, he was a remarkable man. When he was from the States, but he went to Paris to do his doctorate, so he taught himself French to a level where he could go and do research in Paris. And his initial intuition was that Homer was basically what he called a traditional poet. And his first idea was that there are two fundamentally different kinds of poetry, traditional poetry and non-traditional poetry. And he wasn't thinking about oral at all at this stage, just traditional and non-traditional. And he studied the Homeric text. And what he found there was that you get a very extensive system in Homer of so-called formulas. Okay, these are anyone who reads the Iliad, you'll find it's full of repeated phrases like the great hero of Troy, Hector, often, very often, Hector of the gleaming helmet, of cunning Odysseus, the long-haired Achaeans. So the building blocks are often these sorts of phrases. So he argued that in traditional poetry, and he compared other kinds of traditional poetry, this sort of thing is very common. It's the norm. You get a formulaic system, he called it, system of formulas that's extensive, where you've got a major character like Achilles, you'll find a whole lot of different noun epithet formulas, that is a name plus a descriptive phrase, Odysseus, cunning, and so on. So for a major character such as Achilles, he's called quick-footed Achilles, he can be called quick Achilles, he can be called the hero Achilles, godlike Achilles, he can be called by his father's name, the son of Peleus. And what Parry showed was that these formulas, you've got all these formulas for one character, that each of them is unique. Each slots into the line in a different way. So he talked about this almost as part of the mechanics of composing this kind of poetry. You want a phrase for Achilles that fits into the end of the line, go for quick-footed Achilles that slots in precisely into that position. Son of Peleus, slot in the middle with the beginning. And so even though the character's got all these different phrases, each one has got a different rhythmical shape. So he said this was a system that was abundant, because there are lots of these epithets, and it's economical, because for a major character, each of the phrases about him slots into the line in a different way. Okay, that was his first intuition. Then he came to the idea that actually this is not just traditional poetry, this is oral poetry. This is characteristic of poetry that's orally composed. And that was just a hypothesis at first. But he went to test his hypothesis. To say, well, Parry was a remarkable man. He taught himself Serbo-Croatian. There's Parry again. And took himself off to the then Yugoslavia, to the South Serbian area, where there was still a flourishing tradition of oral composition of epic poetry, and he made an intensive study of it. His assistant, Lord, was more interested in other kinds of building blocks of oral poetry, that is, themes. Something typical of oral poetry, when someone arrives somewhere, or there's a feast, or fighting, is described often in very similar ways. So you get these so-called themes, which are repeated within the poem and maybe across several poems that are on the same subject. Okay, this was the Yugoslav Homer, a man called Avdo Medjedevic. Parry and Lord recorded a vast amount of Yugoslav poetry, but really it was always Homer that they had at the back of their minds. And they came across this extremely talented, wonderful oral poet called Avdo Medjedevic. And they did an experiment with him. Most of his poems were... He didn't know writing, so he hadn't read any of his material. He learned it really through the tradition, through performance. And they tried an experiment. They said, can you do a poem 12,000 lines long? Which is about as long as the Odyssey. He said, yes, sure. And so they sat him down and they fed him cigarettes and coffee, and he basically dictated a poem about 12,000 lines long, which is remarkably structured. It's all entirely composed in performance. The thing to get away from is the idea that he's memorized a poem. What these poets were doing is not memorizing. They were composing in performance, using a specialized poetic language, which they'd learned over decades. His great poem, there it is, in English, I don't read Serbo-Croatian. This is Lord's translation of the poem into English. I read it. Lord gave it to me actually when he was in South Africa, which is wonderful. And it's a remarkable one. It really did dent my prejudices about what a purely oral poet might be capable of. It's unified, it doesn't makes very few mistakes, and there's hundreds of names in it, just as in the Iliad, and so on. Anyway, Parry and Lord were convinced that Homer had been a poet like Abdul. If I can just, let's see if this works. I mean, they had very primitive recording equipment. They had wire, we can't call them tape recorders, recorders that recorded on wire back in the 1920s. And this is actually a recording of Medvedevich singing. You can see in the picture, the previous picture, these poets used a two-stringed instrument called a guzla, and they used it basically to set a rhythm to kind of almost get themselves into a kind of state of almost self-hypnosis. And here's a bit of, I mean, of course, we might understand what he's singing. It sounds rather monotonous to us, but... without knowing what it's about, that's probably enough. But clearly he was able to go on with pauses while he dictated. So he went slower than usual, which may have helped with the composition, while they wrote down, it transcribed everything that he dictated. So as I say, Parry and Lord were convinced that the Iliad came into being like this, that Homer was a poet who didn't know writing. Somebody had the idea of putting his poem down and wrote it out while he dictated it. And that theory has had enormous sway, particularly in the United States, a little bit less in Europe. What's my view? I would say this, and you know, I can't prove it, but they can't prove their theory either. I would say there's absolutely no doubt now that there's an oral background to Homer. I mean, that's something that Parry and Lord have proved without doubt, that these poems, the material and the language of them came through a long oral tradition. But, of course, we've got a text. I mean, the poem hasn't come down to this oral poem. It was written down at some stage. And for me, there are a number of characteristics of the Iliad that I would associate more with a literary work, a work that's written, that's composed using writing, rather than a poem that's purely orally composed. Because even Avdol Medvedevich's great song, it's quite linear. It kind of moves forward point by point. The Iliad, and it's, you know, it's essentially a gripping story of raiding and war. Whereas the Iliad is actually on a psychological theme, as we'll see when we look at the poem tomorrow and the next day. And it's not just linear. You get paths of narrative that are left off and picked up later. And to me, it's got the quality of a poem, or the character of a poem. I'm not making a value judgment here. I just think its character is more like what we find in later written literature than what we find in poems that are transcribed from oral performance. I would say that Homer was someone who grew up perhaps in the second half of the 8th century BC, almost certainly performed as an oral poet, perhaps came to know writing, the alphabet, which was around in Greece by this time, and use the alphabet to record and create something different, you know, which overlapped hugely with his tradition but was something new and different at the same time. A very important thing to always bear in mind is that even if Homer wrote his poem down, there were no readers at this time. So it wasn't, you had this text, but it wasn't for people to read out there. It was to record the poem and as a performance text, something to refer to control performance. That's my guess. And that would explain the fact that it's composed for hearers. It's not composed for readers. It's composed to be heard, not read. And that's why all those oral elements work so well. Things that look a bit odd on the page, when you hear them, they're fine. I mean, I remember we did a complete read-through of the Iliad in Durban some decades ago, and Homer always starts every speech with, and then quick-footed, godlike it is, has said, or quick-footed, godlike Achilles said, makes a speech, and the end is always marked by, so he spoke. Now, of course, on the page, you can see inverted commas, beginning and ending. But when you hear it, you realize, that's exactly the reason why he always has that. These are kind of verbal inverted commas. It's telling us a narrative is stopping, getting someone speaking, the speech ends, and the narrative is starting again. So those things are absolutely work perfectly when you're listening to the poem. Okay, as I said, Homer, I'd just like to end with this. This is one of the earliest. There's a cup of around 750 BC. It was found on the fringes of the Greek world. It was actually found on the island of Ischia, just off Naples. So, certainly not in the heartland. And the remarkable thing is that it's got alphabetic writing inscribed on it over there. It's become known as the Cup of Nestor, because there's an object, a cup of the hero Nestor described in the Iliad. We'll see why it's called that, because this is what's written on it. Doesn't really matter the Greek, but it runs from right to left. It took the Greeks a while to decide which way they wanted to write. Sometimes it was right to left, sometimes it was left to right. Sometimes it went as the ox plows, as they say, bush, off it went like that. Left to right, right to left, and so on across the page. Anyway, that says there's Nestor's man. Nestoros, any eupaton pterion and so on. It says, I am Nestor's cup, good to drink from. Whoever drinks this cup empty, straightaway desire for beautiful crown, Aphrodite will seize him. So, alcohol and lust were associated, been associated for a long time. And to me, if someone using writing casually like that, around 750 means to me, and on the fringes of the Greek world, means to me that writing the Greek alphabet has been around for some time already. So if Homer wrote down the Iliad around 700, he might have already had a couple of generations of writing, alphabetic writing in the Greek world behind him. Okay. That's all I have to say. Time for questions. I mean, I don't know if people have to rush off. I think if you have to rush off, just, don't worry about getting up and going. But if anyone wants to ask any questions, No, I think it's a wonderful poem. I've actually written something about it. For those of you who haven't come across it, Derek Walcott, he was a Nobel laureate for literature, I think in 1990 or so. He wrote a whole body of wonderful. He's from the Caribbean island of St. Lucia, and he's written a whole body of wonderful lyric poetry over a lifetime as a poet. And then he composed this great long poem, Homeros, so he calls it. He uses the modern Greek name for Homer, Homeros. And what you ask, I think it's kind of, I think Homeros is really trying to show the difficult, fraught relationship between kind of a colonial culture and colonized people. That's really what Walcott. Walcott himself had a good education when he went to kind of English type public school. He knew Latin well. So he kind of talks about Homer and the classics as being his echo that's going on in his head and he can't get rid of it. And that's really what you see in Homeros. The characters have got Homeric names. There's Achille, Achilles, there's Hector. One's a taxi driver, the other one's a fisherman. And their conflict over a woman called Ella, or whom they see as Ella, is the subject matter of the poem. There's also an old English and colonial character called Plunkett. And Wolgast is rather disingenuous. He said several times, it's not an epic. Omeros is not an epic, because he said he doesn't want it to be thought of an epic. But it is an epic, really. It's a long, refers constantly to Homer. And it tries to shake off the Homeric influence. He says at some point, when would I not hear the Homeric echoes? And he sort of says, well, he's doing away with that. He wants it styled beyond metaphor. And straight away, after that, he uses another metaphor drawn from Homer. So it's, I think, meant to dramatize a kind of conflicted relationship with the great Western classic.
I don't know whether I listened properly, but if it comes from the oral tradition,
yes,
as you said, wouldn't there be more than one text of Homer?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very valid point. The question is, if the Iliad comes from an oral tradition, would there not be more than one writing down of the poem? The great problem is, when was the poem written down? Some people think that it was handed on orally right down to the 6th century BC, and it was put together in Athens for the Panathenaic Festival, which was the great festival in the 6th century, where we know the Iliad and Odyssey were recited in their entirety. So some people think that's when it was first written down. But, that's a very good point. The problem is that our text is pretty consistent. There are, Homer is by far the most popular poet in the ancient world, so scraps of poetry have been found on papyrus in Egypt, and, just little bits, but you can compare them with Homer's text, and they're usually pretty much the same. And Homer is by far the most popular author. There are more pieces of papyrus of his poems than on any other author. Euripides comes second, Homer was fifth. And there are so-called wild papyri. There are some papyrus texts which have got lines that are not what's in our standard version of the Iliad, which was fixed by quite good scholars in about the 3rd century BC. So there is some discrepancy, but it's not very big. They're kind of formulaic lines. Yeah. So instead of somebody saying, then he stood up and said, or something like it, and then walking away, he stood and said, something like that. It's often formulaic lines that will be repeated where there aren't in our text, or Achilles might be called godlike son of Peleus instead of quick-footed, or something like that. So, they're not, as far as we can see from the time that the poem is in textual form, it's pretty much set.
But surely, if it had been written down centuries after,
yes,
it had been before, surely there must have been many deviations.
There may have been, but we don't know about them. I mean, the scholars that I talked about in Alexandria in the 4th, 3rd, 2nd century BC, they got together vast numbers of different copies of Homer and tried to establish what they thought was the best text. And they talk about texts coming from different cities. The problem is we don't know how different they were. So, there may have been different texts, but we don't know about them. So, for all intents and purposes, what we've got is a unified text, but there's not that much deviation. Yes? You're saying the Greek was not known in the West, so how was Homer preserved and how did it come back to us, to Western Europe later on? Well, as I mentioned just briefly, the Roman Empire split in, I'll be about, I'm not an ancient historian, I think it was about the 4th century, AD. So you had two capitals, you had Constantinople up on near the Black Sea in the east. And that was always the richer part of the empire, a very wealthy area. So you had Rome as the capital of the west. They essentially had two separate empires. But the Eastern Roman Empire was Greek speaking. So they were always Greek speaking. And that empire really lasted until 1453, Constantinople was sacked by the Turks. So it went on for a good 1,000 years after the fall of the Western Empire. So in the East, you know, Greek was always known, the manuscripts were copied, there were comments about, and very luckily, you know, there was the kind of little window of the Renaissance starting in Italy in the early 15th century. And you had a flood of scholars either going east to collect Greek manuscripts or Greek scholars coming from the east to the western part of the empire. And you know, those 50 years or so between early Renaissance and the collapse of Constantinople were crucial for the preservation of modern Greek literature. So Homer, that's when Homer really came back. And the Iliad was first printed in Greek in Venice in kind of late 15th century. Yes, certainly were. But that's where the Renaissance Italian scholars and the Greeks brought Byzantine Greeks over to Florence and learned from them. So Homer came with a whole lot of, it's not part of my subject, but Homer came with a whole lot of Byzantine trappings, that the whole thing was allegorical, it was actually about sort of primitive form of philosophy and science. Homer had his reputation as a universal wise man, all kinds of what we would regard as nonsense that he stripped away. But that was the reception of the text there.
Just for the sake of interest,
yes.
How long did that reading in Durban
take? So it takes about 3 to 4 hours. So the Iliad, you know, for, that's the problem with the Iliad, you know, one would refer. You know, it's an old poem, it's ludicrous, far, far too long. Most oral poems are, you know, maximum about 1,000 lines. So, you know, what people can take in at a sitting. Whatever way you approach it, direction you approach it from, is an exception. If it was written down early, it's extraordinary that such a long poem should be written down in such a early stage. It was an oral poem, it's far too long for.
They took a drink break.
Harriet Lord certainly took drink breaks with their alcohol, they gave them coffee. And that's why they were convinced that the Iliad was an oral dictatorship. Homer had breaks, you know, you can have a glass of wine and it takes a bit more than, you know, do it bit by bit.